This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Carolyn Coleman has been fighting for civil rights for her entire life. She started early, helping her mother collect signatures to improve her segregated neighborhood in Savannah, Georgia. She got involved in the NAACP when she was in high school and participated in sit-ins and protests. Eventually, she got a job with the NAACP and worked in several southern states. Worked with Martin Luther King Jr. on a daily basis in Memphis just before he was assassinated. She moved to North Carolina in 1979 as the new director of the state NAACP, and she's been in Greensboro ever since. Today, Carolyn Coleman is a Guilford County Commissioner, also a member of the National Board of Directors of the NAACP, and the first vice president for North Carolina's chapter of that organization. She joins me now. Carolyn, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Born in Savannah, Georgia. Tell us about your experiences growing up there.
Well, Savannah is a very segregated, was a very segregated city. And most of the people that lived there who happened to have been African-American were poor people. So it was just natural that we'd want to do more to make our city a better city, and we wanted more. I happened to have attended St. Benedict's Catholic School first through sixth grade and then on to public schools. But each of those experiences were tremendous experiences. Just a side here, Clarence Thomas also attended St. Benedict's, of course.
Did you at the same time?
Yes. I'm older than he, but he attended, he and his brother.
Goodness.
His grandfather sold coal and ice, and I would see him picking them up from school in the afternoons. However, I didn't know he would be the Clarence Thomas that we know today. But Savannah was a city that, as I indicated, most people there who happened to have been African American were poor. And so it was just the kind of thing that as you grow up in that city and you live on streets that were unpaved, you knew that things had to be different. When it would rain, there would be big puddles of water in the street and the cars would drive around to the side of the puddle. There were no street lights. Everything that you would want to improve your quality of life, you didn't have in Savannah.
And part of that is knowing that others did have that quality of life. It's something you saw taking that bus to the Catholic school every day, right?
Every day. Of course, the signs would indicate that whites would sit from the back toward the front and blacks would sit at the back. When my brother and I would get on the bus, there were no seats available because it was full of high school students who happened to have been white that were going to the white high school. Ladies at the back of the bus, who were maids for the most part, would make room on that last seat for us to sit, just kind of sitting in a little space there on the way to school. So we saw segregation in every phase of life. I lived maybe a block from a skating rink, which was an open-air skating rink, and we could sit outside in the yard on Saturday nights and see white kids skating. We heard the music playing, but we dare not attempt to even go to that skating rink because we knew that we would not be accepted.
Well, I'm curious to know what else was going through your mind at that time. It's easy enough to imagine internalizing this and saying, well, this is just the situation. Do you feel anger, contempt, resignation? What's going through your mind?
To a certain degree, at first, I think our parents tried to shield us from that.
Yeah.
And then they finally told us, you know, you can't go because this is a segregated community and black people would have to sit on the back of the bus and whites at the front and all of the things that you'd experience. I can remember even going downtown to shop and whites would sit at the lunch counter. Blacks would have a little hot dog stand that they could purchase a hot dog and stand and eat. So as our parents talked to us about how bad things were, I mean, they would say, but things will change. They will get better. They always felt that if we got a good education, that would help make those things better. And so they did everything that they could to see that life for us was going to be better than it was for them.
And apparently in your family, that didn't mean just waiting. Your mother was very active in getting improvements in, for some of those conditions that you talked about earlier in your neighborhood,
yes, right? Yes, yes. Because of the conditions with the streets and what have you that I just mentioned, she and some of the neighbors would always take petitions downtown to the city council to try to get the streets paved, try to get lights in the community, of course, to no avail. I'd graduated from high school, and I believe maybe it was my second year in college before the streets were paved in my community.
But you got employed in some of those efforts to make change, right, to get it, signatures on those petitions, right?
Yes, yes. Throughout my tenure with the NAACP, It reminded me of the fact that my mother had instilled in us that if you make a difference now, life will be better. And so I thought maybe I met the NAACP director for the youth in my region. And so I thought perhaps that's a job that I would want to have. When I graduated from college, I was about to take a job in Columbus, Georgia. And my best friend said the NAACP had been banned in Alabama, and now they're hiring people to go and reorganize units in that state because the Supreme Court, after 9 years, had said that we could go back in. And so the two of us went to Alabama to organize youth units. There was a staff of three adults who were organizing adult units. And let me just talk for a minute about those memberships that the governor of the state of Alabama was after. It seemed that if you were a teacher in particular, he did not want you to be a member of the NAACP. So he decided to raid the NAACP's office and take the membership list. Of course, there were some black people who were working in his office, just cleaning and dusting and what have you, and they heard the conversation, knew that the Highway Patrol was about to come and raid the NAACP's office. So they made a call to the NAACP director, Ruby Hurley, and told them that the Highway Patrol was on the way. She and one of the other staff members, Mr. Patton, took the list and flew to Alabama, just got in the car and drove as fast as they could, to Atlanta, drove as fast as they could to get to Atlanta. Thus, the NAACP's membership list was saved. So, of course, the NAACP challenged us in court, and that was when we were able to go back in and reorganize youth and adult units.
Well, I mean, this idea of banning a political organization is something that, you know, only happens in totalitarian states. It's incredible that they got away with it for 9 years. What was the premise? How do you ban an organization like that?
Well, the governor said it was illegal, and believe it or not now, they're not too far away from that in some instances now. In the state of Alabama and Mississippi, where they still fly the flag, as you know, in Mississippi, the Confederate flag. But the governor said it couldn't happen there, and it didn't happen. Now, of course, this was the time when Hoover was the head of the FBI and what have you. So we didn't even have the FBI completely on our side. And to try to get it into the courts was difficult. I can remember as a child, and I had no idea who Warren was, but I remembered seeing signs on cars that said, "Get rid of Warren, impeach Warren." And it turned out that he was our best friend. He was the
Earl
chief.
Earl Warren.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, he was the head of the Supreme Court, man. The chief justice there.
Appointed, I think, by Nixon. I'm going to ask somebody to look that up, if you wouldn't mind. But I think this was one of those interesting stories where there's an appointee by a Republican. They assume that he's going to be a conservative, and then it turns out
that
that's not who he was, and surprised a lot of people later on. It was a Republican president. I think, we're going to take a look, and I'm going to clarify that in just a moment. So talk about this, because before you got there, you were also participating in sit-ins, and in fact, there was a boycott in downtown Savannah that was very effective.
Yes. Actually, when I was in the 12th grade in high school, The NAACP's vice president, Curtis Cooper, came to speak to my American history class. And in his discussion, he talked about the NAACP's Youth Council, which at that time was preparing to have demonstrations in Savannah. So he invited us to come to the meetings, and of course, several of us did attend the meetings. When we arrived, we found that here we were about to replicate what had happened in Greensboro with the sit-ins. And so we participated in the sit-in demonstrations there. Now, it was interesting because there was a group of about 50 of us that day who were participating in the demonstration. But there were several what they call five and dime stores along the main street there, Broughton Street. And as students would approach those stores, the lunch counters would close. But we happened, my group happened to have been in the last group that was going to the last store on that street. And when we arrived, our store was wide open. The policemen, I guess the salespeople, everybody was outside just waiting on us to come. And of course, we walked on in, took a seat at the lunch counter, and after a few minutes, instead of the waitress coming, the police came and said, "If you don't leave, we will arrest you." Well, we were prepared to be arrested, so we sat there. And of course, we were taken down to the jail at that time. When we were bailed out, our president of the NAACP said, "We now must expand this to the entire community." And so he called a mass meeting on that Sunday, which is just a gathering of people from across the city coming to hear our story and see what we would do in the future. When we arrived at the church, I mean, people were standing outside. You just could not believe how many people were there in support of us. And what they decided to do, one woman threw a credit card down on the floor, and she said, "I'm no longer going to purchase anything from," and she named the store. And when she did that, credit cards just flew through the air, all on the floor, just all over the place. It's amazing how many people had credit cards. But at any rate.
Well, that was back in the days where the store would have the credit card, right?
Yes. At any rate, what they decided to do then was to call a boycott of all of the downtown stores. And of course, that boycott lasted very successfully for 18 months. We did not shop in those stores. We did not spend a penny downtown. And that was, I guess, the time when people were just so intent on making a difference that you could just see it in everything that they did.
What was the effect?
Well, the effect, first of all, was that these downtown businesses were closing. Some of them just could not remain open because we were spending a lot of money downtown. In addition to that, of course, Savannah has always been a city that had folk coming around tourism, and the tourism business stopped. They just didn't want to be involved in that kind of thing. So that made a difference. Even back in the 60s, it made a difference.
So then fast forward now, you talked about the fact that this gets you involved in the NAACP. They send you to Alabama, where the NAACP had been banned for several years. Finally, the Supreme Court overturned that prohibition. So what was it like then to enter the state of Alabama after that hiatus?
You know, there's something about being young and naive. My girlfriend and I went to Alabama to work. And of course, we'd lived in Savannah and we'd heard about how bad Alabama was, but we had no idea how bad it really was. I mean, everything in Savannah was segregated, but everything in Alabama was doubly segregated. You almost felt like you could not drive down the street without the fear of something happening to you, with being stopped by the police or challenged in any way. So we went to Alabama. And this was after the Birmingham effort there. But it was just at the beginning now of the Selma to Montgomery March. So we were in Alabama for that. And, of course, drove through the very same area that Ms. Viola Luizio was killed in. And she was a white woman that had come down from, I believe, Ohio or one of the Midwestern states to work around voter registration. And at any point, anybody could be shot. So we were just fortunate that we were not the ones that were killed at that time.
Was that your focus? Was it voter registration?
Always voter registration. And that's because we felt that power would was in the hands of the political people. So if we could make a difference there, you know, power is what makes a difference in lives and communities. And if we could make that difference there, that would certainly change many of the problems that we had.
Well, the theory is sound, but of course it's dangerous, as you pointed out. And talk about the effort in trying to talk people into this very dangerous prospect of voting if you're African-American in a state like Alabama.
Well, Alabama and Mississippi had some really interesting laws, especially Mississippi. But Alabama, in particular, would ask questions like, how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap in order for you to register to vote? And, of course, if you knew that, then you'd own the soap company. But at any rate, there were questions asked that had nothing, absolutely nothing to do with registering to vote. But in some of the counties and places like Birmingham, it was not quite as bad. But in some of those smaller counties, what that we call the Black Belt, it was almost as though if you took it upon yourself to go and register to vote, at any point you were taking your life into your own hands. Mega Evers had been killed in 63 there in Mississippi. Vernon Dahmer had been killed. All of these are NAACP leaders. Mims down in Florida. So all over, people were being killed simply for registering people to vote. So again, we were young, had no idea how dangerous it was, and just did it because it was the thing to do.
But the adults who lived there all their lives, they understood. And I wonder what it was like for you and whether you could be persuasive in that environment to persuade people, yes, the time has come, let's do it now.
We had to. We said to them, and this was crucial to most people, we left our homes to come to help you. We left Georgia to come to Alabama and Mississippi to help them register to vote. Some of them were afraid. Some would say, well, I'll do it tomorrow, or I'll do it next week, or whatever. They never said, oh, I'm afraid to do it. But they did try to dissuade you from taking them to register to vote. Interesting enough, you always had to take them downtown. Now you can just give someone a form to complete and have them register to vote. But as we'd walk the streets, going house to house, you'd have to take those people one by one downtown in order to get them to register to vote. So you can imagine how much time and money we spent just trying to get 10 people registered in a day. It took everything that we had.
Well, as you say, it's dangerous even moving around in a city like that and
yes.
Once they know what you're up to. So I can certainly understand the fear of people who might be reluctant.
And quite often we had ministers that would go out into the community with us. They knew their parishioners, and they would encourage them to register and ultimately to vote. But quite often we were out there, two women alone, doing that work.
You moved to Memphis eventually, and this was as the sanitation workers' strike was underway and Martin Luther King was organizing there. Talk about that.
Well, I'd worked in Alabama and Mississippi as what you call a task force worker for the NAACP. They paid us $25 a week, and of course, my dad had bought me a car thinking that I was going to teach school and make the payments, but he ended up having to make the payments for me. So here we are now, after our work in Alabama and Mississippi, and my friend went back to college. She had one more year. After we left Alabama and Mississippi, they gave me a full-time job in Memphis. I was a regional youth director. And of course, just, I guess, maybe a year after I was there, James Meredith came wanting to desegregate the University of Mississippi. And so he marched from Memphis to the University of Mississippi, and we marched with him for 3 days. On the fourth day, we didn't go back because we were back and forth to Memphis every night. The fourth day, he was shot. So that was the first thing that happened. And then following that in 68, the sanitation workers had been out just collecting garbage, and it started raining that day very hard. And some of them sat on the back of the truck. Well, those old sanitation trucks had pieces that would gather all of the garbage and pull it into the truck. One man was still sitting there when that caught him and pulled him into the truck, and it ultimately killed him. They didn't have any benefits, none whatsoever, but white employees who worked for the city had the benefits. So they decided that they would protest, and I can see them now wearing the sign, "I am a man," because they had to collect money among themselves to bury this gentleman that had worked with them. And of course, the NAACP, the SCLC, and several other community groups, labor union, AFSCME, was right there trying to organize them into a labor union. And of course, we protested for several weeks. And then the leaders felt that things had to escalate. And so they decided to call Dr. King in. I believe that the history is that he was scheduled to go to Greensboro at the time that he came to Memphis. And of course, we scheduled one march, got downtown, and some of the students started looting and breaking windows in stores. And we ended the march right there, never finished it. And the second march, of course, was scheduled. And that before that took place, Dr. King was killed. I can remember coming home from work about 5 o'clock that afternoon, and it was on the radio that, you know, he'd been shot. They didn't say he was dead at that point, but later did say that he'd been killed. And of course, the entire city just erupted into violence.
Did you have a chance to meet him?
Yes, actually, I worked with him in Alabama when we were involved in the Selma to Montgomery march. And then, of course, when he was in Memphis again, we were in little strategy sessions from time to time. I was still a very young person, just having graduated from college a few years, but they always involved young people and women. Surprisingly enough, we didn't have to fight that battle to involve women in the movement.
Well, now, there are many who argue that you did, including Ella Baker, who would say, you know, in starting the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that women weren't involved enough, that they didn't have enough of a position, and young people. That was also her argument when she helped to organize SNCC at Shaw University, in fact. What would you say to her? She was saying that, you know, both young voices and female voices didn't have enough standing.
And I think that's the key word, enough. We were involved, but not enough. When I joined the NAACP's Youth Council, young people were involved across the country. We even today have over 750 youth units and college chapters across the country. There were 3 national board members who were young people. And of course, we protested, and we're divided into regions. So they gave us 1 for each region. So even today, there are 7 youth board members who are guaranteed a seat on the board. Now, no one ever said anything about women in particular, but we were there. Now, I definitely know that Miss Baker was at a higher level than I was. So perhaps at that level, we didn't have as many women. But I did talk earlier about Ruby Hurley, who was the person that came from the national office down to Alabama to start units in that state. So there were some women, not as many as we needed, and even now we don't have as many, but women are throughout the organization.
Let's go back to Memphis for a moment. You talked about sanitation workers organizing initially their own protest at first. How describe more for us how the whole thing came about and whether it was from the ground up. Did they come to you and say, we want your help? Were their protests spontaneous? And then, as you say, unions and other civil rights organizations came and filled in pretty quickly.
Yes. Well, they were picketing the city hall wearing these signs. And, of course, as a black person, you can't drive by every day and see them out there picketing and leave them out there. So somehow I think the ministers became much more involved, and then those others of us joined in. But just any time somebody's picketing, you want to know why, and if it's for the right thing, certainly at least I've always felt that I had to join in.
But interestingly enough, this in some ways opens up another front for the civil rights movement, because clearly this is a case of injustice, right, and inequality. White workers are getting these benefits, black workers are not. But it is a labor issue now, and this sort of opens up another front. Was there any discussion along those lines that maybe this is a fight that we shouldn't take on?
As always, as somebody who felt we shouldn't take this on, shouldn't take that on, but as far as the NAACP is concerned, we've always considered ourselves to be a part of labor. In fact, I was a member, as a staff person, I was a member of Local 1707, AFSCME. So we've always, well, I wouldn't say always, but for a number of years, we did have organized labor involved with us. But when you start moving toward the South, it's altogether different. Because, as you know, we have the right to work states and what have you. And so it's very much like Dr. King becoming involved in the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. There were people who said, oh, we shouldn't do that. That's expanding our horizons. We just can't do it all. But, of course, the leadership made those decisions, and we just went after it full force.
After Memphis, it was on to Atlanta, am I right?
Yes. Actually, I was back and forth between Mississippi and Memphis, doing registration in Mississippi and of course, in Memphis. And then ultimately, the NAACP sent me to Atlanta. Now, I'll have to tell you that I felt like I was going to heaven. I mean, here were black people who actually were elected to public office. There were black people who owned businesses, people that were lawyers and doctors and what have you. So to become involved in a community like that, of course, we still were fighting racism, but not quite as much as in those other states.
What was your focus at the time when you got to Atlanta?
Always registration. But in Atlanta, they had gone through the demonstrations with sitting in and that kind of thing. And so what we decided to do was two things. We'd register people to vote, and then we would try to improve our community economically. And so on Saturdays, we would have a gathering in a neighborhood where we'd drive from that neighborhood downtown to the Black Bank and have people open accounts at the Black Bank. So economic development was very high in Memphis, as you can look at the airport and see all of the things that black people have been able to achieve there. But economic development meant that blacks had businesses that they owned, had businesses that we worked in. And it just, like I said, it was almost heaven for me.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Carolyn Coleman today. Spent almost six decades with the NAACP, got her start as part of a youth council when she was in high school. She participated in sit-ins and protests in high school and college, started working with the civil rights organization in southern states, and finally came to North Carolina in 1979. What brought you here?
Actually, I had been offered, my program that I was directing in Atlanta was expiring. You know, I was directing a program where we assisted people in purchasing food stamps. and the federal government changed the law so you no longer had to pay a portion of the food stamps. So that program was expiring. So I had an opportunity to come to North Carolina or go to New York. I had a son that was about 5 years old, and I just thought that New York was not the place to try to rear him. My family's still in Georgia. So I came to North Carolina as state director because Charles McLean, who was the director, was retiring. And so
that put you in Greensboro right away.
Exactly.
At an interesting time, because it was not long after that that there was a high-profile incident involving the Nazi Party, the Ku Klux Klan.
I always tend to get around at the time when something's about to happen or has just happened. And I was 2 weeks into Greensboro. In fact, I was out shopping for a refrigerator, and I got this call that there had been this killing of the Klan Nazis, Klan and of some of the Nazis by the Klan. And of course, I'd seen signs posted on the trees and whatever about this big rally that was to take place, and I assumed that was the rally. Well, it turned out that the Knoxes did have a rally down near Morningside Homes, which is one of the lower income housing projects there. And the Klan had come in at the dare of the Knoxes and, of course, started shooting. It was unbelievable. The videos that captured that, these men were running around as though they were in the Wild West with guns, just shooting at people. And, of course, six of them were killed at that time.
Yeah, and also there were civil rights workers, anti-protesters also involved in this. And, of course, in the fallout, the sense was, and there was some widespread belief and perhaps a certain amount of evidence that the Greensboro police knew what was going to happen and where they would be and armed and pulled their police protection out of that area.
Exactly. And in fact, the police department was sued and lost the suit because they were able to prove that to be a fact. Now, why it happened like that, I don't know. There are those who think that because the Nazis were the Communist Workers' Party, people didn't want to have any involvement with them. And
yeah, so, it was the communists too, and I don't think the Nazi was the Communist Workers Party and the KKK, right? And so those two clashed.
Yes,
and communist the Workers Party members were killed in this clash. But this is 1979, and the Ku Klux Klan is still active and still acting with the complicity of the police in 1979, as the suit demonstrated. Did you think you were still there when you took on this role in Greensboro?
Actually, I did, because I'd encountered the Klan across the Southeast. Mm. So why wouldn't they be in Greensboro? When I came, there had been an altercation between the Communist Workers Party and the KKK down in China Grove, where the KKK were meeting. Mm-hmm. So I was very much aware of some of that. And of course, all kinds of things were taking place across the South. So you just knew that it had to happen in Greensboro, in North Carolina, as it did in other states in the South.
At a certain point, Governor Jim Hunt came knocking on your door.
Well, before that, I had been involved, of course, with protesting there with the Klan and Nazi killing. And, of course, as I indicated, we did win a suit in court there. But then we had a gentleman out in LaGrange, North Carolina, which is the Kinston area. Mm-hmm. Lenoir County is the county. And he was mentally deranged, was in a cornfield and had taken off his clothes and had a corn stalk in his hand. The police were called and they came and just killed the man. Said that they thought he had a pipe in his hand. Never tried to talk to him, talk him through any of this, just killed him. And of course, this was the first time, and this has been debated as to whether he really received a sentence, but the police did receive a 5-year sentence for this killing.
This is a black man that you're talking about who was killed.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we went on to Anson County, where a gentleman was sitting in a truck, and again, he was mentally challenged and got into an altercation with an off-duty policeman and ended up being killed. And of course, again, the police received a sentence there. But these incidences took place across the state of North Carolina. Now you would think that North Carolina was far more progressive than some of the other southern states. And to a degree, we were, but not as progressive as we should have been.
So talk about Jim Hunt and how you came to his attention.
Well, I had a dear friend who is now deceased, Ben Ruffin, who told Governor Hunt that he should talk to me. And, of course, the governor called me and talked to me about his work and the fact that he was going to be running for re-election. This would have been his third term. He'd served for 2 terms and was out for 2 terms, and now he was going to run again. And he wanted to come down and talk to me. Well, he walked into my office, and he said, "I have hired all of my staff, but I still need one person, and that's you." And of course, I mean, I just fell in love with the possibility of working for this man, because he's just a jewel. He still is. And so I decided to leave my position with the NAACP. I took a leave of absence, but of course that didn't last long, because they were calling for me to either come back or make a decision to go on, because the work needed to be done. And so I served that year on his staff, working to do outreach for minorities coming into his campaign. So I worked the entire state of North Carolina. And then, of course, he won the election. And so I was hired as his special assistant. And, of course, in that position, I was able to bring in, my main responsibility was to see that we recommended to him the hiring of persons at the very top of his administration. And he always said that he either wanted a cabinet secretary, a deputy, or an administrative person to be in every department. And he did just that.
What's the value? You know, you'll hear a lot of people say, as long as everybody's doing a good job and that they're fair in the administration of their job, it shouldn't matter what color they are. What's
well,
the value?
First of all, it just makes a difference in terms of understanding cultures and communities when you can bring in people of all cultures. And so I think that it makes a difference to the citizens when they see someone that looks like them. I mean, I just said to some people that I work with recently, I wanted them to hire some African Americans, because I go there often for their services, and there are none. So anybody wants to see a person that looks like them at some point doing the work. And so I think that's very important. But there also is an understanding of what's going on and what these people need. I say to people all the time, I was able to make a tremendous difference on the outside. But once I got on the inside, I knew how to make it happen. And I was able to make things happen for my community.
What sort of things?
Well, we were able to hire people not only at the very top of his administration, but throughout the administration, because once he left, his political appointees would leave too.
Right.
But there needed to be people within that administration that would move up to the top as other governors came in. In addition to that, we were able to get contracts for architects and contractors, what have you, that we had not gotten in the past. And so it just made a difference to be there and make things happen, and to see that people were actually, one of the contractors is now one of the major contractors in the state of North Carolina. And one of the architects that did tremendous business with us is now ill and unable to do some of that work, but he did good business with the state of North Carolina.
It would seem in 2000, the year 2000, you may have retired from government work and come back to Greensboro, although you didn't really retire, did you?
Well, you know, just prior to the year that the governor was leaving, we'd had the flooding out in the eastern part of the state. And, of course, Princeville, which was just unbelievably damaged by the floods, had water marks on the side of the houses up to the roof. And so I had an opportunity to work with county governments, city governments, and what have you, to make some changes in those communities. And so when I went back to Greensboro, I knew that I would have to be involved in government. And so I thought about city council, but a county commissioner's seat came available. Katie Dorsett, who was one of the governor's secretaries, her husband had replaced her, and now he was retiring. So I was able to run for that seat and be elected to the county commissioner.
What's your focus there?
Everything. But, you know, again, it's the same kind of work that I did in the governor's office. We've been working to bring in minorities to contracts as contractors. Now a big fight is to see that we get some programs that impact us in particular. I've been working with an outreach program to begin developing a program around reentry for inmates who are now in prison, in jail,
right,
and will return to our community. And I say to people, if these people went to prison or went to jail and they come out and they have nothing to do, that recidivism rate just continues to grow. And so we want to provide some jobs for these communities, for these people in our community.
Voting rights, still an issue after all these years here in the state of North Carolina. We've got a voter ID bill that's been tossed out by the courts. We've got redistricting that is in the courts and at various times it's been ruled unconstitutional. I mean, you talked about the bad old days in Alabama, and of course, Jeff Sessions, who was once our attorney general, was infamous for his efforts at voter suppression in the aftermath of your efforts in Alabama. What do you make of what's going on here in North Carolina?
Well, I felt that, again, we had to challenge it. And so I was one of three lead plaintiffs in a suit to challenge voter ID. And, of course, we won at the federal level in Virginia, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, only to have to come back to North Carolina and have the General Assembly not accept that and now trying to change the law again. And I almost feel as though I'm just living my life all over again. I mean, it's the same battles over and over again, but I believe we will prevail, and that's all you can do is keep hope alive.
What about on the ground? You know, again, keeping hope alive for more fair and just legislation on the books, and then the effort to register African-American voters in as a response to this. You can almost imagine becoming tired of the argument over all of these decades. Is there a kind of fatigue out there in terms of what's the effort like and what is it like these days in the registration field?
Well, you know, there are people who do get tired. And of course, all of us get a little bit fatigued at times. But every now and then we have a victory. And I look back at Obama's election. That made it worth everything that we'd done in the past. And hopefully now we'll have another victory in the next election. So things don't always end up the way you want them to go. But I believe if you keep working at it, you're not going to have all negatives all the time. And while we have a Supreme Court now that may be perhaps more conservative than we want it to be, I just believe that things will get better. I don't know how, especially with all of the federal judges that have been appointed that are now conservative. But I just still believe, if you don't believe, I don't think you can do this work.
My guest is Carolyn Coleman. She believed and has believed for decades. She's a Guilford County Commissioner, also a member of the National Board of Directors of the NAACP, first vice president of the North Carolina chapter of that organization. You can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Carolyn, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You can find out everything you want about this show at our website, stateofthings.org, and also sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of the State of Things lineup. Also, Movies on the Radio is coming up. We want to know, what is your favorite film about nature and the environment? Does James Cameron's Avatar stand out? Maybe Aaron Brockovich's Fight for Environmental Justice? You decide what we mean by nature and environment and tell us about your favorite. You can email your pick to sot@wnc.org or tweet at us at #SOTMovie. To be on Movies on the Radio, State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson engineered the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.